Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, October 3rd, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This episode is for all the ladies. It's also for the guys, though. You'll like it, too. But before we jump into it, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. We rely on support by listeners like you. And when I say we, I mean I, because this really is a one-woman band. You can support the show in a ton of ways. Tell your friends about it, tweet about it, Facebook, rate and review on iTunes. You can visit the Talk Nerdy store at my website, www.carasantamaria.com. Or you can visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/talknerdy. The big supporters this week via the Patreon portal are Phil T-Bear, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much for your support. All right, I'm really excited about this week's episode. I know I say that every week, but it's always true. This week, I have a chat with Karen Garst. She's an author and an activist, and her most recent book, Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, is now available everywhere. All right, guys, without any further ado, here she is, Karen Garst. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so excited that we finally get a chance to sit down together and chat.
Well, the pleasure's all mine.
So, if I were to describe what it is that you do, would I be appropriate in saying that you're an author and an activist?
Excellent.
Okay.
I would feel pleasure with both of those.
Good, good, good. So, obviously, you have a new book that is it coming out? It has not come out yet.
Technically, it's released October 1st, but Amazon and Barnes & Noble started shipping 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think the Kindle, you can pre-order it on the Nook, but that might not be released till October 1st. And I don't think it will be in bookstores till October 1st.
Oh, well, then this is absolutely perfect timing.
Later on, an audio is coming.
Okay, cool, cool. Are you going to record your own audiobook?
No.
No, no. They're like, no. Well, this is actually really great timing for the podcast then. So the book is Women Beyond Belief, and it's a compilation of essays of individual women's experiences, kind of in how they live a non-belief or a secular, however you want to word it, life, right?
That's correct. And it's important to say the whole title, Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, because there happens to be another book with a similar title. So,
gotcha. So Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, which is a great way to live your life. I can attest to that. So what got you interested? I mean, I have to go way back, just even before the manuscript, but when you first started getting into this kind of culture, what got you interested in this secular approach and in the activism that comes along with it?
Well, I would say I've probably been an atheist for a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And at that time, when my husband and I quit going to church, I never joined any atheist or humanist group, never really thought more about it, just kept on with my life and raising our son. And then in June of 2014, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. I'm sure you and your readers are familiar, your listeners are familiar with that. But they decided that Hobby Lobby, because of its religious views, didn't have to provide certain forms of birth control to its employees. And I was incensed. And a couple of days after that, I was having lunch with a friend of mine who's a novelist. And she said, well, Karen, you should write a book. And I said, the only thing I can get passionate about is atheism. So I decided to write a book, and my focus is women. I started out with friends, and then I reached to the atheist communities, and then I reached through social media and ended up with 22 women, all different backgrounds, ages 18 to 70. Now, they all do come from either a secular background or a Judeo-Christian background. Mm-hmm. And they each tell their personal stories of either being raised secular or being raised in a religion and leaving it.
And do you tell your own story?
My own story is in there. It's not one of the most exciting ones, but I was born in North Dakota, so you get a guess what religion it probably was.
Oh, wait, North Dakota. I don't know. Would that just be like Lutheran? Is
No.
that a thing? Yeah.
You nailed it. A plus.
Yay.
Lutheran, and I grew up in a time where everybody I knew went to church, or there
Yeah.
were some Jewish families in town. They didn't have a full-time rabbi, but I knew in first grade who was Catholic, who was Lutheran, and everybody went.
You were going to church. Were your parents particularly religious, or were they just kind of going with the flow?
No, my father was very religious, and
Really?
my mother, as a lot of women are, the ones who took us to church, to Sunday school. She taught Sunday school. My dad had he was a radio technician, so he had an odd schedule. So it kind of fell to her to get us everywhere. And of course, she didn't drive a car back in the day. And so we pretty much walked everywhere. So we went to church. I went to catechism. I was confirmed. I was in the Luther League, and I often say that without Luther League, I probably would have had no social life in high school because we went bowling, we did other stuff like that, and we got together for potlucks every Sunday, and it was a great group of people.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a similar experience when they are raised in religion, where they remember the social aspect as being really meaningful to them, and it and forging a lot of really good friendships, and feeling a really positive contribution of the socialization within religion. The real issues that they have generally tend to come from a cognitive and emotional place that's about the actual values or about the actual dogma that's established
Well,
within that faith.
exactly. And some of my authors went through, like I said, mine wasn't the most exciting, but some of them who were raised fundamentalist, and they talk about the guilt and the shame. One of them says, it wasn't just that I commit sin, but I'm a woman, so I am sin. And that really affects your psyche. This woman just struggled when she tried to get out of religion to let go of all the damage that had been done. And she, I mean, it's really tragic.
It really is. I think for a lot of individuals, but also for kind of women as a whole within society. And here we're talking about kind of an American society with Judeo-Christian values, but obviously we can extend that to other societies across the world that are sometimes even more oppressive. It does kind of build in this sensibility that is very hard to shake. Even after you leave the church, you sometimes find yourself having particular kinds of thought patterns that really you would have never had if they weren't ingrained into you.
Well, and I think one of the ways that affected me most was the issue of sex, because my parents never talked to me about sex. I remember asking my mother at the zoo why the llamas were riding piggyback,
Oh
and
my
she didn't.
God.
And she didn't tell me why the llamas were riding piggyback, but I actually got a copy. My sister had a really like a porn novel, and I read it, and that's what I figured out about sex. I mean, that's not a healthy way to learn about sex. I was taught that you were going to be a virgin when you were married, and when I slept with a guy who promised to marry me, and then of course I never saw him again in my life, that does affect how you approach those type of issues. So in that area, I think it affected me the most. Never learning that it was healthy, it was okay, all of those type of things. The other thing I think is really interesting that I've been thinking about lately is, and it would be great if a psychologist did a study on this, but what is the impact on girls and women who pray to a male figure their entire life? How does that affect your image of who you are? And Martin Luther, of course, I was raised Lutheran. He was very misogynistic. And one of the things he did in Protestantism, they all did it, was eliminate the reverence for the Virgin Mary. They eliminated all the saints, including the female saints. So they basically took away any semblance of females within this religion. And I think that would be real interesting to examine, saying, our father, his son, what does that do to your own sense of worth?
For sure. I mean, I think back to when I was maybe a late teenager when one of my sisters got married, and she wasn't able to get married in the temple for various reasons. And they actually had, because I was raised Mormon, so temple, that's where that comes in. And they had just a little church with a little reception with the bishop, a ceremony right there in the church. And so I actually got to see not all of the things that they do in the temple, because there are a lot of, weird things that they do that you're not privy to when you're not able to go. But I was able to see just a traditional kind of ceremony. And one of the things that really got me was when the bishop was having them do their vows. And when you think of a traditional wedding ceremony, it's do you, woman, take your husband, or take you, man, to be your husband, blah, blah, blah. Do you, man, take your woman to be your wife, blah, blah, blah. And in this case, it was, do you, man, agree to serve God in all of the decisions that you make, yada, yada, yada? Do you, woman, agree to serve your husband in all of the decisions that you make? It was soul crushing to hear it. And I remember talking to my dad about it and being like, what's that about? And he had some bullshit explanation that through transitive property, somehow you're just as close to God because your husband is your conduit. It's like, I don't think so. That's kind of not okay.
Yeah, and that's sometimes the least of it in a marriage. Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we know that there's systemic problems with rape that occurs within the marriage, with all sorts of verbal abuse, and just with a huge kind of imbalance of power. And that's just when you're talking about two people and how they're shaped by religious influence. You see that spread out amongst a society, and it's not surprising that we see some of the massive systemic sexism and misogyny that kind of follows us wherever we go.
Exactly. One of the things I did for the book, I put an appendix in, and it's the subordination of women in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And I can assure you that when I was growing up, the pastor talked about Isaac, and that God at the last moment said, "No, Abraham, you don't have to kill him." But nobody talked about Jephthah. He was a man who asked God, "Can I beat the Ammonites? If I do, I'll give you the first thing that walks out of my house." Lo and behold, he beats the Ammonites, and guess who's the first person that walks out of his house? His virgin daughter. And God,
Of
of
course,
course,
right? Oh, who would have
yeah.
thought?
And does God say, "Oh no, Jephthah, you don't have to kill your daughter"? No, his daughter gets killed. But people bury all the bad stuff. But there's so much negativity. And what I find really interesting is I've done a lot of research on this, and there used to be, well, we all know there were goddesses in a pantheon, whether it's Roman or Greek, etc. But before that, there was very likely a mother goddess, a feminine divine. And it's so interesting to study the memes that are associated with that goddess and then see what happened, for example, in Genesis with a woman in the Bible. Generally, snakes were part of a symbol of a goddess. So, what do we have in the Garden of Eden? We have a snake. We have a tree, which was associated with one of the goddesses in Canaan, Asherah. We've got that symbolized. So, we have all of these things to make what was positive for women negative. And then, of course, we have the red tent. We have the fact that they're unclean. They can't be priests. They can't enter the temple. And even in the New Testament, Jesus said, "Well, leave everybody and follow me." Well, that's fine for the guys, but who stays back to take care of the hearth? Well, it's the women. So throughout history, and the other thing I learned about was, in the Middle Ages, there was a proclamation called Malleus Maleficarum, and the church, I think it was a couple of bishops who wrote it, and it was a justification for killing witches. And hundreds of thousands of witches were killed, most of them women. But you never learn about that. You never hear about that. All you hear about are the positive things. Well, there's a lot of negative in there, and it's particularly negative against women.
And it's kind of no wonder that a lot of that sentiment has continued to persist even until modern times. And honestly, like, it wasn't that long ago when here in America, women were being burned at the stake for being witches. When here in America, you saw these really sort of unequal and unbalanced judicial kind of outcomes for females versus men. And of course, you see it as a result of other religions, especially in certain parts of the Middle East, when you have women being prosecuted, even put to death after a rape, or that they're unable to get married after a rape, when obviously they had nothing to do with it, yet they're the ones who are punished.
Well,
for
and it's
that.
Even worse in other parts of the world, or when those cultures come to Western society but still maintain their cultures. I was just at the Women in Secularism conference, and on my long plane ride across the country, I read a book by Aruna Papp called Unworthy Creature, and she was born in India, and as a young girl, they were lived very closely together in a poor area, and she saw probably a 12, 14-year-old girl, a neighbor, burned to death, immolated, because she had done something, or maybe not even done something, but there was shame, and the honor of the family was so important, and of course, they got away with it. And Aruna, for example, is somebody who came to Canada and has spent 30 years fighting to educate police about honor killings, because it occurs in Canada, it occurs in the United States. And there's been examples here. So even though we have our own problems here, and I don't believe we have full gender equality, it's really bad in other parts of the world. And the dominant reason is religion. I think religion is the last cultural barrier to gender equality.
Yeah, religion really has been used as a tool and as an excuse to continue the oppression of women really across the world. In almost every culture, you see this tool, and it has such staying power. And for whatever reason, when it's done in the name of God, when it's done in the name of the Lord, people really do look the other way. And it's just obviously incredibly frustrating as somebody who is a secular thinker to try to have that conversation with religious individuals, because there's a disconnect there.
Well,
there's kind of a justification.
Yes, and the public broadcasting system about a week ago had a special on a group of women who were forced into marriage very young, you know, under 16. And they started an organization, Unchained at Last. And we know we have the Queer Film movement, where your job is to sit there and have one child after another after another. Even within the United States, that is occurring today.
Ugh, that's so sad. That's what the Duggars are, right? They're
exactly. And Vicki Garrison is somebody who's left that and has written about how terrible that was.
So you've probably had an incredible opportunity throughout this kind of chapter of your career to travel, to go to conferences, and to meet amazing women with amazing stories.
I certainly have. I had the opportunity to attend the Reason Rally. I had created these little cards for my book, and I passed out 1,500 of those. I was hoarse from saying, oh, here's a new book about women atheists. Here's a new book about women atheists.
That's where we met,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
At the Reason Rally.
And I attended the mini convention where you spoke, and a number of women spoke, and men. And I can say that everyone I have met in the last 2 years has been incredibly helpful. Peter Boghossian lives in Portland. He has been a mentor to me. John Loftus, just a number of people that I have met that have been very helpful. And then, of course, attending that conference last week, it was phenomenal. They had, I think, 35 women speaking on different panels from really all over the world, all different aspects, and it was so educational. And then, of course, you get to meet people, you know, on the breaks and during dinner, and I really learned a lot.
How has it felt dedicating your, you know, most of your time, your efforts, in many ways, your career to investigating some of the issues that secular women face, and to trying to enlighten the public about women in secularism?
Well, I'm somebody who needs a project. And I retired. I was executive director of the Oregon State Bar and some other positions before that. And the first thing I did was research my genealogy. So I spent 5 years doing that, trace back that I was a patriot in the Revolutionary War, joined the Daughters of the American Revolution. And so I always need to have something going. And to me, what's interesting is I've been to, hundreds of conferences. But I've never been one that I have been this passionate about. And so I really enjoyed it because this was something I care deeply about. So many times when you go to conferences for work, they say the same thing or it's something you've read. And this was just exciting to meet this many people who are involved. And my second book is going to be Beyond Judeo-Christian, and it's going to address all the different reasons women should leave religion, whether it's science and critical thinking or whether it's LGBT issues. And it's going to be much broader in terms of its scope. And I've already secured about 10 or 15 women who are willing to write. They're not going to be personal stories like this one, but more logical arguments and to really expose people to what other women have gone through.
Sure. And that's great to kind of expand it to that that background that's not just a Judeo-Christian background. I do think it's important and it makes perfect sense for your new book to have that focus because most people, at least here in, I would say North America, I shouldn't even say in just America, but most people in America, Canada, and even Mexico and probably South America too, that's the background that they come from and that's the background that they identify with the most and it's the most familiar. But then once you go across the pond, you really do start to see a lot more stories of oppression that come at it from a different angle. Not that Islam is that different than a Judeo-Christian background. There are so many similarities. And we are seeing, you know, growing groups of individuals, both refugees and just individuals who emigrated here to America, who have those kinds of backgrounds. And I think it's an important perspective that we don't always get to hear.
Exactly. And hearing specifically about the honor killings that are still going on, it's really tragic. And I think we need to do our part. I mean, I don't know that I've ever felt this passionate about something that I've undertaken. I mentioned that U.S. Supreme Court decision. I grew up in the 50s and 60s when there wasn't birth control very readily available. When I was in college, our student newspaper, we decided to publish an ad about New York because it was the only place, this was before Roe v. Wade, the only place it was legal. And of course, it happened to be Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, which was a Lutheran college. They impounded all the newspapers and destroyed them. They wouldn't let us send it.
Wow.
They wouldn't even let us advertise or to let people know that here was another place you could go to. And I have a 26-year-old son and I don't want, and he has a very nice girlfriend. And I just look at both of them and I say, you shouldn't have to go through what I did. I want to be able for the millennials to say, you're never going to have to worry about this again. You're not going to have to keep fighting for reproductive rights. You're not going to have to keep fighting for equal rights. We did that and we don't have to keep doing it. And I've never been so excited about doing something.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because for the most part, I felt in most of my adult life that ship has sailed. That is established. And there are, you know, obviously constantly forces working to repeal Roe v. Wade or to roll back that kind of progress. But we sometimes, but for the most part, I felt pretty secure. And I even grew up in Texas. So obviously, there are specific states where they do everything to bend the law that they can. But we sometimes forget that across the world, most women are not as lucky. I just watched this amazing documentary on Netflix called Vessel about Women on Waves, which is this Dutch organization that basically chartered a boat and goes out into international waters where the laws of the land don't apply and offer women non-surgical abortions, like abortions using pills, in an effort to help women who live in places where they cannot get an abortion legally, and they resort to the most depressing and horrific means to end pregnancies when they need
to. Well, and there's always been abortion. I think one of the things that's kind of hypocritical, particularly about the Catholic Church and its stance on abortion and condoms, et cetera, is in the 19th century, abortion was legal. It was supported by the Catholic Church up until the moment they call quickening, which is when a woman can feel the fetus moving inside. It may be 24 weeks or something like that. And then it's interesting that the American Medical Association formed, and who was doing the midwifery? Who was doing the healing? Well, it was women traditionally, herbal remedies, different things like that. Well, the American Medical Association formed, and it was predominantly men. What better way to wrest this away is to make it illegal. And so that was part of the start of making abortion illegal. And the point is, there's always going to be abortion. The question is it going to be safe and accessible and affordable or not? And are women going to die from it?
Yeah, because they do. I mean, that's the hard truth of the matter. And you can avoid it all you want and you can make it illegal, but you're not preventing women from having abortions. You're just making it so that when they do, they're resorting to incredibly unsafe, unsanitary, unhealthy, and potentially fatal practices, because there are just certain situations in which not only is it not convenient, or maybe it's, oh, I don't really want to have this child, it's not possible. It's physically not possible for women to always have children when they get knocked up, and they will resort to an abortion that's absolutely not healthy. And it's just so heartbreaking to think about how desperate a situation one must be in to be willing to do some of the terrible things that they have to do to terminate pregnancy because there's no viable medical option available.
It just I personally have had an abortion, and there was a woman at the clinic, and she was married, and I think she had had several children already. And she came there. She couldn't have another child. Like, I can't deal with it. I can't handle it. And I don't think the husband ever knew. But it was available to her to do, to say, you know, I got pregnant. We just can't do this. And I think now in an era of, you know, population growth that's going beyond what the planet can sustain, it's even more important to be able to, you know, now that we have the ability to do that. When I was doing my genealogy, looking at these old census reports from the 18th and 19th century, it was a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and they had a child every single, every other year, because there was no form of birth control that was effective. What I look back, even a generation or two, and to think what women had to do all the stuff in the home without any devices that helped, and then had all of those children. It's just amazing that they were able to do it. I mean, women had 10 and 15 kids.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we think about our own genealogy, or we think about our own histories, and everybody's story is different. But often when we think about the woman in the home with all the kids, we think of the man off working and bringing home the money, and at least there being some amount of stability and support, regardless of how atrocious that cult of domesticity was for her. But I think in modern society, it's such an unfortunate truth. It's such a kind of sick joke by nature that the people, the women who need the abortions the most, are the ones who are often least capable of getting them because they are struggling with economic inequality. The reason they can't have another kid is because they can't afford to feed another kid. And that makes it that much more difficult to be able to access healthcare services and do what needs to be done to have a safe and healthy
abortion. And you mentioned Texas. I mean, they have put, fortunately, the Supreme Court recently ruled against one of their moves, but by doing so many restrictions, somebody can't travel 200 miles.
Yeah, it's crazy. They're like, oh, yeah, we have clinics in Texas, but we have like two, you know? And people don't realize how big, I mean, I think it's gotten a little better, but people don't realize how big Texas is. You can drive for 18 hours and still be in Texas.
Exactly. And so I, and the other thing I think is important to note, the lack of federal support for Planned Parenthood and all the opposition to Planned Parenthood. Look, if you're personally opposed to abortion, then you should be so pro birth control and want to fund that and want to educate people. But I was in, you know, during the Reason Rally, the Secular Coalition of America had a lobbying day, and what we were lobbying was for medically accurate sex education. Our federal government funds abstinence-only sex education. It's been proven not to work. By and large, kids have sex at the same rate, whether they know about it or not, and those who are least prepared are the most likely to get pregnant. And yet, our federal government funds that. And to me, you know, I don't care what somebody thinks personally. You go in your house or you go to church on Sunday, but you can't trample on other people's rights, and our government is dominated by religious people. You couldn't
Oh,
run for
yeah.
president and be on that debate stage and say, I do not believe in a deity.
No, completely. And I think people, we're comfortable with the phrase separation of church and state. We're comfortable with the idea of the First Amendment. But when you actually start to dig a little deeper and look below the surface, we are absolutely a nation of religious privilege. We have incredibly strong lobbies that promote religious ideology in the way that laws are written. Our legislative efforts are incredibly biased toward sort of heteronormative, traditional family, Judeo-Christian values. And one of the things that's like so incredibly, I don't know, so incredibly frustrating to me is the point that you were just making, that individuals who care about, that are like actually pro-life, or maybe I shouldn't say pro-life, but individuals who actually care about overpopulation and about the economy and about reproductive health should be for abortion, yet they're not oftentimes. And the only reason for that is
Well,
religion. I have never been able to sit down across from somebody who is pro-life in a way that they think it should trump other people's rights and it not have some sort of kernel of religious ideology
and
in
the
it.
Catholic Church, who was proselytized in Africa. I have one of my authors who was born in Zimbabwe, and she talks about, you know, we were just fine before the Christian missionaries came. And one of the things that she talks about is this having multiple wives and young children as wives, and that wasn't all that common before, but it was condoned. And the other thing about Africa is all of these Christian missionaries now, they're not allowed to let people have condoms. I mean, a health organization, if it's a Catholic health organization and you've got a community that's got a lot of AIDS incidences, they can't give out condoms, which to me is, wait a sec here. You've got a terrible epidemic, and you're not even going to give people protection for that?
I know, it's insane. And you have this rhetoric that somehow condoms cause AIDS that becomes pervasive within the culture. I'm always throwing documentaries out because I'm a huge documentary nerd, but there's an incredible documentary that came out in 2013 called God Loves Uganda, which was made by Roger Ross Williams, who is a homosexual Ugandan who kind of went there to explore how the because Uganda has a terrible human rights track record for homosexuality. It's punishable by death, or at least at the time it was. And he makes this strong connection between this anti-gay sentiment in the nation and all the way up to the highest levels of government and this unholy alliance with white American evangelical Christians who go into these nations, who proselytize, who, you know, do their missionary work and actually partner oftentimes with people with a lot of strength in the government to cement this ideology. And I can't for the life of me wrap my head around how these individuals can convince themselves that they're doing good.
It's hard to understand, but you know, when the Spanish came and conquered the people in Central and South America, they just killed thousands and thousands of people. I can't remember the name of the documentary, but I kind of remember the music that went with it, but it was just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And here they come to a country and basically destroy everything that's there and kill people. And then they justify it by their missionaries and they're teaching people about God. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's just so incredibly depressing. And I think it's wonderful that that your new book actually brings some of these issues to light by hearing the personal stories of individuals who have experienced it, of individuals who can tell their stories. You know, the truth of the matter is it's very hard for us, I think, just it's a human condition. It's hard for us to connect with ideas and movements unless there's a strong story component attached to them and unless they feel very human. When it gets to be at the legislative level, sometimes when we start talking about policy, and we start talking about different referendums and things like that, we become very disconnected from it. But when you can put a human face on it and you can speak in words that everybody understands, it's so much more effective to tell these kinds of stories.
Well, and I did wanted to say that I'm so proud of you being a woman who is a scientist. I'll tell you a story. In ninth grade, we learned evolution, and this was before any intelligent design. Nobody walked out of the room. My dad supported it, everything. And I think I wrote a paper on early man, and I was fascinated by it. And, you know, I held on to that paper, I think, for 30 years. And every once in a while, I look back at it. And if there would have been a model of one woman scientist or one science teacher who was a woman or somebody who encouraged me, I think I would have gone into that field. But, you know, you were a teacher, you were a secretary, you were a nurse, and those were the options that were available to you. And it's not like you couldn't have persevered, but it's very hard to do. And I think we do things by models. If we see somebody else who's done it, who looks like us, like that picture of that small African-American boy looking at Obama, what did that do to him to saying, look, here's somebody who looks like me who's president of the United States. Maybe I can do it too. And so,
and you're right. I mean, we need role models in those areas, and we historically haven't had enough. I mean, there have been some incredible women in the secular movement, don't get me wrong, but there haven't been enough. And it's great to see a growing group of these women.
Reading the book is somebody can read one and go, wow, you know, I don't have it that bad. If she can do it, I can do it. Or find somebody, you know, I've been thinking about that. Yeah, that's true. And I have no fault with the great writers in the atheist movement who are men. And if you look at the top 100 best-selling books on atheism on Amazon, out of 100, there's only 5 or 6 who are women. And they're great books, and I've read a lot of them. But it's not the same as identifying with a person who is writing. And if you can identify more closely with somebody, it's easier, like you said, to understand the story, to empathize with it, to identify it, to apply it to your life. Can I read one of the excerpts?
I would love that. Okay. Oh, yes. Wonderful. And before you do, give us a tiny bit of background on who it's by and kind of, you know, their story.
Yeah, this is the first essay in the book, and it's a woman whose family doesn't know, and she's using a pseudonym, but she was raised as a fundamentalist Christian. So I'm just going to read 3 short paragraphs here.
Great.
The problem is my mind, my heart, and my will were the fundamental tools I needed for knowing myself, for connecting with other humans, for making wise choices, for having empathy and showing compassion, for setting clear boundaries, for living a whole and satisfying life. But when my religion demanded that I believe things that were irrational, mythical, or contrary to human decency, it had to undermine or destroy those fundamental tools. What else would they have done? If they hadn't bent my mind, I might have wondered why there are such an amazing number of things in the Bible that make no sense. If they hadn't suppressed my feelings, I might have decided that human compassion is more important than obedience to dogma, and I might have rebelled at being commanded to love a being who sent billions of people to hell. But in my world, I was flirting with eternal fire to question any of this, and I had no desire to take on the Almighty. As submission to this dogma eclipsed my thoughts and feelings, I lost the ability to know what I really thought and how I really felt. It became almost impossible to give and receive love or to trust. It became possible to accept things that violated my integrity as well as human decency. And when she finally left religion, she wrote and wrote and wrote to try to process this. And the story has a happy ending. She emailed me a few weeks ago, and this is a person who lives in Oregon. She was at the beach, and we have a beautiful beach. Mm-hmm. She said she sat down and had an epiphany. She said, "It was the first time in my life, I think, that I have felt serene, that I was okay with who I am." And she said, "I think writing the essay had something to do with it." So if we can reach other women who've had similar experiences, who can say, it's okay to trust yourself. You can be moral without God. You do not have to be chained down by shame and guilt for every single thing you do. It's going to be a better world.
Absolutely. And it's true. You know, sometimes I forget because I left the Mormon faith when I was 14, and there was probably a solid 10 years of real struggle with my family and real struggle emotionally with that decision. But I'm well on the other side of that now, and I live in Los Angeles, and a lot of people here are secular, and a lot of people here are really progressive. And I sometimes just forget. I mean, I do what I do on the podcast. I go to these secular conferences, but I sometimes forget how many people there are out there who are still struggling with this, of all ages, of all genders, of all backgrounds, who are trying to come to terms with what they believe and how they feel and how they think. And it's so important, I think, for us to be able to empathize with that experience, because some of us have gone through it, some of us have yet to go through it. But we're all on the same team, you know, and we all want to be able to find our joy and not be saddled with the guilt that inevitably comes when you first make that decision to be honest with yourself.
Well, in some of these denominations, there's another woman in the book who was a Jehovah's Witness, and she was in college and she fell in love, and she slept with her boyfriend who was not a Jehovah's Witness. And somebody turned her into the church, called her before a tribunal of three elders, three men, who were going to, it's called disfellowship, kick her out of the church. And that has huge implications in a community like that, because if that would have happened, her family and her friends would have been forbidden to have anything to do with her. Now, fortunately, in her case, they decided not to disfellowship her, and she ended up marrying the young man, and they have two kids and lived happily ever after. But it could have been so much worse. And then later on, she discovers that one of the men who interviewed her and challenged her for having sex was having an affair with a married woman. So how hypocritical can you get? Or look at all of the sex scandals in the Catholic Church. That I had no idea that this has been going on for thousands of years. There were, I was reading the other day about, you know, the early church and how much abuse there was. Mm-hmm. It's not just a recent phenomenon in the Catholic Church.
And it's so sad that it's gotten to the point, I think, for many of us, where it's like, doesn't surprise us anymore. You know what I mean? It's like you hear these stories and you're like, yeah, that's like, yeah, that makes sense. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that, not that we've grown numb to it, but that it's so expected at this point that it's hard to find outrage every single time you hear about it. I mean, how depressing is that?
Exactly. And if you look at religion, it's kind of like a lot of other things. It's power, it's control. If you look why religions got established, it probably organized religion happened more after we formed cities, we came together, and we had property and owned land, and there were the people who wanted to take it away. So you kind of protect it and you come together. And what better way to do that than saying they don't believe the way you do, they're wrong, so go kill them. It's a great justification for creating the other. And I think we do that today. If they're not of the same faith, we look at them differently.
Oh, completely. You know, the in-group, out-group dichotomy fuels every conflict that we can think of. I mean, this is obviously airing a little bit after the fact because we're recording it just the day after the very first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I mean, what a beautiful example of what you're talking about, and what a perfect example of the kind of overt yet under the radar misogyny that, you know, just the way that the two of them interacted, the way that Donald Trump cut her off every time she would start to say something, interrupted her. You know, we use the term mansplaining. There was a lot of that going on. It was a case study in that.
There was somebody made a joke at the conferences. Where does a mansplainer get his water? Well, where? Actually.
Oh, yeah, right? I mean, it was, yes. And we've all, and that's the thing, we've all experienced that as women. Any woman listening to this podcast can think about a time when she was at a social event, when she was in the boardroom, if she's even allowed in the boardroom, when she was, you know, at some sort of vocational meeting or something like that, where we've been completely mansplained to. And only recently, which is a cool thing, has there been this kind of label, you know? Yeah. Only recently have we been able to point to it and go, oh, that's like a bad thing that happens to all of us. I just thought that was like kind of the nature of like men being awful. It's like, no, that's like, it shouldn't happen.
Well, and but we all experience some people, it. My website, Faithless Feminist, there's a lot, I didn't realize it because I'm a second wave feminist and really hadn't been paying a lot of attention, but I've gotten a lot of pushback for that word. And people say, oh, we have gender equality in the United States. Well, when I was an undergraduate, I applied for a fellowship to Dartmouth to go to graduate school. And the only woman, that's, you know, we're talking about internalizing this, the only woman on the committee, why should we give it to you? You'll just get pregnant and have kids. And yeah. I didn't get the scholarship. And then when I was working, I won't say which position, but they were hiring somebody who was in a quasi-separate organization but connected. And I was very careful to say, look, here's my salary. Here's what my managers are making. If you put this person right here, given how many employees he's going to have, et cetera, it would match up with the overall organization. And they didn't. And they paid him $30,000 more than me. And I said, excuse me, but I had a lot of support. I had a woman on my board who said, if you need a lawsuit, we'll do it. And they did a study. We had a consultant come in, and the woman said, who did the study said, let's see, she has three times as many employees, more responsibility. The only conclusion I can reach is that it's probably sex discrimination. And you know what? I got a $30,000 raise. You know, I've, for my whole life, every job I've competed with has been, you know, usually with men. And I've persevered and I've done really well. But you have some of those incidences and you go, excuse me, I don't think we have gender equality yet. You know, when a woman can send in a book with a woman's name and gets rejected and she changes the name and sends the exact same book in and gets published, we have a problem. When you've got an actor and actress who are playing similar roles and one gets paid differently. So we've got a ways to go. We're certainly better off in a lot of countries, but we're not there yet. And I've gotten a lot of pushback, as I said, you know, against the word feminist. My marketing person has suggested godless grandmother. And I said, let's not promote that I'm a grandmother. Let's go with faithless feminist. But I try, when I get a comment on something I've posted, to respond to that person, to try to educate them, whether it's on something I wrote or a comment they made. And sometimes I go, what would you think if your mother saw that? And a few times you can kind of educate and turn people around. But you know as well as I do, there are some videos on YouTube from people to not be named who are incredibly misogynistic. I wasn't all that aware of it until I started this effort, and I've been really surprised at that.
Oh, yeah, about how overt it is and how many followers there are of, these kind of, they call it the quote-unquote men's rights activist movement.
Yeah.
It's true. I'm not somebody who studies this very often. I'm not somebody who delves deep into it. I just try to operate, on the science tack. I try to do what I can do in secularism and do what I can do in the work that I do. And sometimes you find yourself kind of stuck in the middle of these things and you don't really fully understand the culture surrounding it. And the few times that my toe has been inadvertently dipped into these worlds of just blatant misogyny online, and I see a glimpse into the culture behind it, it's horrifying to me. It's a rabbit hole I don't want to fall into because it will break your heart to see how deep it actually goes and how overt it is, how like certain people, they're just not even hiding it.
Well, and I remember one of the positions I had when I finished my doctorate was as a union organizer, and I represented a lot of classified employees in school district and did a workshop on sexual harassment, encouraging people to file a grievance if something happened, to come to us. And a woman stayed after and she told me what she was experiencing. And she said, I just can't risk filing a grievance.
Yeah.
I can't afford to lose my job. I'm afraid that if I complain about something, that that's exactly what will happen. And she never did.
Isn't that so sad that it's so systemic, that there are situations when what is necessary legally, the necessary legal recourse is actually, there's so much fear around doing that because the whole system is just not set up to support it. And unless you're like lucky enough, like in many ways that you were, to have other women in positions of power in the company where you work or to already know lawyers and be in with them, a lot of women don't have that. They have low-level careers. They don't have a lot of upward mobility. And they're surrounded by men who are not sympathetic and they don't have any allies.
Exactly.
Ugh.
And I've been fortunate. I've had a lot of education and I've learned to stand up for myself. But look at what happened with Fox News.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not even, I think it's so sad because it, at a certain point, it's not even about being able to stand up for yourself. We do that. And you're right. I think that we are in a more privileged position than a lot of women across the world. But yeah, even at Fox News, at a place where these are very strong women, and I hate hearing it. I hate hearing other individuals saying things like, oh, well, she just needs to stand up for herself. I think there was something with like some kerfuffle with Trump's daughter saying something along those lines. And it's kind of like, no, my God, you're so tone deaf. It's like that.
Well,
when...
and there was a.
Oh, go ahead. No, I was just going to say that's when like the terrible outcomes often, that's when the drama starts for a lot of these women. It's like, it's a really big decision. Do I keep my head down and deal with it? Or do I actually stand up and say something? Because I'm not sure if I have the capacity or the economic capability to start to fight that fight.
Well, and if you look at culture, I'm not going to remember his name because I'm not a football person, but there was a man who was nominated for the NFL Hall of Fame about a week ago, and he was convicted as a serial rapist.
Yeah.
And people will say, well, yeah, but that doesn't have anything to do with football. You're talking about a Hall of Fame. You are putting this person on a pedestal, and you have to look at the whole person. How can you possibly consider this person for the Hall of Fame? Is that what you want your daughter to see? Is that what you want your wife to see? Or Is that the culture we
I
want?
know. And
I was appalled. I couldn't believe it.
it's not like there's anything about this sport. I mean, it's obviously a sport that we think of as aggressive, but there's nothing about the sport that has to be misogynistic. And I think some of the players who I most connect with, I don't know much about football either, but my boyfriend sometimes will watch like the shows about football. Like there's an HBO show called Hard Knocks where they'll follow a team each season during training camp, or I'll watch Real Sports. And you start to identify with the different players as characters, as people. And so many of these, because they're young boys oftentimes, and so many of them are just sweet young boys who are trying to make it work, who have daughters, who have wives, and they're working really hard. It's like, why aren't we celebrating those characters? Why aren't we showing that you can play an aggressive sport and yet still be an adult and still be a man? And maybe the way that we should be defining what it is to be a man is to be a feminist, you know, because there are some great role models out there who are totally feminist, totally feministic men who are also big and burly and strong and make millions of dollars playing professional sports.
Well, when I was married about 30 years ago, and my husband had been married before and had two children, was divorced, and we decided to have a child. And I was working full time. I took 2 months off, and he took 1 month off. And this was really new for him. And he did say that success would be whether they were both home when I got home. But, he was willing to share and take that responsibility and look at the wonderful opportunity he had to share in that. I just spoke to somebody the other day who took 6 years off and stayed home with his child and while his mother worked, while his wife worked. What a great opportunity to share those roles of raising children
Oh,
together.
yeah, I'm seeing that more and more. There's a family that I'm very close to, young parents, a little older than myself, who have a young daughter who's like profoundly gifted. And she works and she travels a lot with her work. And he works full time too, but he gets to work from home, which means that he gets to be there with his daughter when she needs him, which is such a great thing to be able to share in the parenting in that way. And I think we're starting to see a more and more progressive movement in that area. But I forget sometimes I go back to Texas or I talk to my friends who never moved away and they'll tell me about their fiancés or about a guy they were dating. And they'll say these comments, like you'll hear them say crazy things like, oh, I'm never going to change a diaper. Or like, oh, well, I'm the dude. Like, I can't be expected to do that. And you're like, are you kidding me? How is a woman, I mean, this just gets back to the conversation we were having previously. How is a woman expected to be able to manage so much, to care for herself, to care for her children wholly in some of these situations, fully without any support except maybe financial support? But as we know now, more and more often, women are having to be breadwinners as well.
Well, I'm really glad. And my son wrote me this. He's 26, and he wrote me the nicest letter the other day about, the best mom, et cetera. And I really had an example of intelligent woman who was very strong, and it was really nice. But my husband retired before I did, and I said, "Well," his name's Sam. I said, "Sam, I'm not doing your laundry anymore. Your dad can do it, but let me tell you, he doesn't know how to sort clothes." And my son said, "Okay, teach me how to do it. I want my clothes to be nice. You teach me." And my son was 11, and he did all his laundry ever since then. So he, that's how he was
And
raised.
that's so important, you know. One last thing I'll say before we move into the closing segment of the show, but again, with the documentaries, I don't know what it is, but there are two incredible documentaries, both by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, that I recommend everybody go and see. The first is Misrepresentation, which is a really good deep dive into how women are represented in positions of power and, the lack of women in positions of power and how that really does affect large-scale organizations like government and multinational corporations. And there's some incredible interviews with some very interesting and powerful women in that documentary. And then she did a follow-up documentary a few years later called The Mask You Live In, which is all about how we raise our boys and how we should be raising our boys to be more in touch emotionally, and we should be telling them that it's okay to cry and that they don't have to act aggressive and they don't have to act tough and they shouldn't dehumanize women. Because I think a lot of times we have these societal pressures we're breeding it into men from a very young age. And it's kind of hard to even blame them when you've been socialized so much throughout your life to have certain viewpoints and to have these interactions. You know, we need to be making changes from the time that boys are very, very young in what our expectations are of them and how they're treated as compared to girls.
I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah.
And we are capable of doing that.
We absolutely are. And there are many incredible parents like yourself who have been doing that for a very long time, who are just very progressive and ahead of the curve. On that note, Karen, before we go, because we've been chatting for over an hour, which is awesome. The time always gets away from me. I want to close by asking you the same two questions I ask everybody who I have on the podcast. And I think that your perspective is going to be extra interesting. So here we go. When you think about the future in whatever context, you know, is meaningful to you, number one, what is the thing that worries you the most and kind of keeps you up the most at night? And on the flip side of that, number two, what are you most hopeful and excited about?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm most concerned about is climate change and what we are doing to the planet and people's being totally oblivious to us, denying it. I hope we don't get to the point where there's a point of no return.
Yeah.
And I'm very concerned about that. I'm very concerned about warfare with nuclear weapons. I'm concerned about North Korea having that capability and other countries, because that would really destroy so many people, our civilization, etc. The hope, I think the hope is that when we meet people who are different than we are, I think we learn a lot. I remember when I had a friend who was gay and my brother moved to my city and he'd never met anyone who was gay. And he would maybe say something negative. And after he met Craig, he knew that person who was gay. He never said anything negative again. So as we meet people who are different than we are, as we get to know them, I think we can identify the common humanity in us. And hopefully that will get us through.
Hear, hear, sister. Well, hey, let everybody know where they can find the book and how they can find you. You know, are there different social media places where you're more active?
Well, if you want to find me, you just Google Faithless Feminist and you will come up with my website, Facebook. I have some videos on YouTube. I don't do a lot of that, but when I do a presentation, I put it up there. And the book, Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it will soon be in bookstores.
That's so great. Well, congratulations on the book. I'm so excited that we were able to have this chat. It was really enlightening and really exciting for me to be able to have, I don't know, just like a badass episode that's all about women. It reminds me of a pair of socks that I was just wearing yesterday that say motherfucking girl power on.
Well, it was extremely enjoyable.
Thank you so much. And hey, guys, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.